Hey, so we were going for a walk a month ago, and we had this conversation where, as we were on our walk, you got a piece of news that someone was following you on YouTube, someone you'd reached out to. And for me, I was like, that's great. You know, they got your email and they know you exist, and you had kind of a dark response. Do you remember what you said?
Yes, so this was a radio personality. He does a great podcast radio show about, we're interviewing people, all kinds of people, but a lot of writers. And I sent him a note, curious if he'd be interested in my book and chatting with me. And a few days later, he followed me on Twitter. And just to see his name there scared the shit out of me, because my first thought is, if anyone has any expectations of me, they're going to be disappointed. I mean, it turned out he read my book, he liked my book, he wants to interview me, everything's good. But that first moment of somebody's looking at me scared the crap out of me.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, our guest is Yuvi Zhalko, author of the new novel I Only Cry with Emoticons from Red Hen Press. Yuvi's first book, a brilliant novel in the works, came out in 2012, and his short stories and essays have appeared in Glimmer Train, Narrative Magazine, Carve Magazine, Rosebud, and the Los Angeles Review, among others. Yuvi is Portland's own king of all media. His creative work extends beyond the printed page and includes the podcast Neurotic Tornado, animated YouTube videos, blog posts, and even an iOS app. In the words of novelist Monica Drake, I Only Cry with Emoticons is a sly, forthright comedy about the intersection of love and technology, men and women, and the way our devices have become a loud third wheel. I couldn't put it down. Please join us for our conversation with Yuvi Zhalko, which is already in progress. Yuvi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks, Ken.
Now, Yuvi, in addition to your two novels, and we're here to talk about the latest one, you have a collection of blog posts, videos, podcasts that are full of insight about the writing process and an incredible resource for an interviewer like me. And I'd like to start with one blog post that you titled, A Story About Mistakenly Writing and Publishing a Novel as a Way to Take a Break from Writing Another Novel. And that's from about 2.5 years ago, December 2019. And it starts, quote, around 5 years ago, I was chugging along in a novel that was a pain in the ass for me to finish. It was a big, messy, sprawling piece of historical fiction, and I couldn't quite bring it together. On top of that, I was struggling at my day job at a social collaboration software company and struggling with my connection to family and friends. Basically, I was miserable. How'd you turn that misery into this great new novel?
Well, thank you. So I think for a lot of my creative work, I have to trick myself because it's so easy for me to get in my head and sabotage anything I'm doing if I'm thinking too hard. So in this case, I had to just say, forget this other novel I was working on, which I happen to be working on again now, but for the moment, I needed to take a break, and I'm just going to just spill out whatever I'm dealing with at the moment. And it was struggling at work, struggling to connect with friends and family. I happened to be working at a social collaboration software company, and that whole social collaboration stuff kind of messed with my head. So I just wrote just a joke story. I mean, I didn't think it was anything real, just about a miserable guy going through all this stuff. And, as if a few pages into it, I realized, like, oh, this is pretty good. Maybe it's a funny little story. And I kept on working on it. And then I had a story and I sent it to my agent saying, here's the big historical fiction mess I'm working on. Here's a short story that probably doesn't mean anything. And she read the story and she's like, it sounds like you're having a great time writing this thing. And I think it's a novel. And I just was so offended that she thought it was something more than just a little, you know, way to vent for the, at first. And then I realized like, oh, maybe it is a novel. And then I got excited about it and turned it into a novel, and one that I felt ready to write. The historical fiction one I was working on, I felt like maybe I wasn't quite ready to write it. This one, it just blew out of me. I mean, it took years to finish, but that first draft just shot out of me because I was just dying to tell that story.
Yeah, you mentioned in the blog post that you took about a week off and got a motel room, wrote in a cafe, and you had about a 30,000 word manuscript at the end of the week. And then it took another year to double that and turn that into a novel. And then there, of course, a lot of revision after that. I was curious, though, about the historical novel. Was that semi-autobiographical, too? I'm wondering if that's why it was such a tough slog, because it didn't have the same elements as the first two books.
Yeah. And, you know, that one is one, if you're my new novel, I Only Cry With Emoticons, the character is struggling to work on a story about his grandfather.
Yes.
And I can't help write too much of my stuff into my novels. And the story I was working on, and again working on, is the story of my father's father and their immigration story from Poland to New York to rural Georgia. And so I think part of why I wasn't quite ready is, one, it took a huge amount of like understanding of that time and place. And it wasn't, I had to get into the headspace of my grandfather and grandmother, who were fictionalized over the years, and I wasn't quite ready to do that because I was struggling with my own baggage in a certain way. And so I needed to take a break from that and write something a little closer to home, so to speak.
Well, I didn't realize that the novel that Saul's trying to write in the book about his grandfather and bringing a lot of these things in, he was a shopkeeper, I guess, in rural Georgia, and the Ku Klux Klan were coming to burn down his shop. So I assume that's going to play a big part in the new book.
Yeah. If I ever can get it out of my attic, which I'm hoping will happen soon, it is this story of living in this small town, and mostly, you know, interesting people. You know, there's a few scary elements to it, but mostly it's just how do you kind of build your community when you're an outsider.
Now, your first book, A Brilliant Novel in the Works, features a main character named Yuvi, which could just be a coincidence, but I think it's somewhat semi-autobiographical. The new novel's narrator is named Saul Baum. He has a few things in common with the real-life Yuvi Zalko. It's a process that seems to work very well in your fiction, and I think you said you're basically using that in the historical fiction or certain elements. In one episode of a podcast you did that I listened to, you say that in a novel, you like to start with your own traits, and then you wonder what it looks like when you take it up a notch. Is there an example or two in the new book, Emoticons, that you can tell us about where you took it up a notch?
Well, one really easy one where I took it up a notch, and as I'm preparing for these book events, I keep telling myself, don't forget to say this out loud, which is, I'm pretty happily married. My wife and I have a really great relationship. But, you know, we've had some tricky moments in the past where, you know, we were trying to work through some stuff. And you know, in the novel, I Only Cry With Emoticons, I kind of imagined, what if things went wrong? Like, what if I was too lost in my own baggage to know how to make the connection to my wife? And so the character in the book's marriage is falling apart, and his relationships are falling apart, and his career is falling apart, and his relationship with his son is not great because he's so obsessed with his novel and other things. So all those things are variations of me if I went down the, you know, a messier path. So they all started with me, but I just made them worse and maybe took my ungraceful moments in life and focused on those things.
I could say from listening to podcasts, your wife is very different than the Saul's ex-wife in the book. Well, they're separated. They're not quite divorced yet.
Right.
Now, you have a good friend and writing group colleague, and also she was your initial podcast co-host, Jackie Shannon Hollis, a wonderful Portland-based writer. She wrote a memoir titled This Particular Happiness, A Childless Love Story. And you, of course, choose this more semi-autobiographical approach in your books. You fictionalize it. What attracts you to fiction rather than writing, say, a straight memoir?
Yeah, and I should say Jackie and I we're in a writing group together, and so I've seen drafts of her memoir, and she's seen many, many drafts of my novel. So I love working with her. I think what I love about fiction, and I've dabbled a little with like personal essays, but what I love about fiction is everything goes in a way so I don't have to think about, did it really happen exactly this way? I love the freedom, and with fiction, I don't get in trouble for mistakenly telling the truth, but I feel like if I were writing a memoir and I mistakenly lied, I could get in trouble. So I love the freedom I have with fiction, but it is a little weird. And I know it puts some people off that I really walk this line, you know, even in my first novel that I named the character myself. And then I'm having to explain to at my readings, like, well, that didn't really happen, even though the fictional UV, it did happen to. But I still like walking that line. And I've always been attracted to metafiction or stories where you don't know, is this the real person talking to you? Or is it the fictionalized person? I read Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge a bunch of years ago. And he just starts off saying, you know, I have so much misgiving in writing this novel, but that's the Somerset Maugham character in the book talking about the book. I love the way that makes me ponder the story in a new way.
Yeah. I also thought maybe it is a comic novel at heart with a lot of serious topics in it, but Jackie's book is fairly serious. Liz Scott, who wrote a memoir too, we had her on the show. She's part of the Portland literary community, very important part.
Wonderful.
That's fairly serious too, but a comic novel, I think, maybe works better as fiction than as memoir. Hmm. It's hard to be funny in a memoir, I guess. Even comedians.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And the humor is definitely a key element of how I tell a story. And I have written some personal essays that had some humor to it, but I think I just have a natural... it unlocks a little more for me if I just say it's fiction and go from there. And basically it's like I start with fiction and walk the line from that side of the aisle. But you know, I could see doing it the other way, but somehow starting, assuming it's fiction just helps me feel more free.
Now you mentioned the writing group with Jackie. It's the Pinewood Table in Portland, led by Stephen Allred and Joanna Rose. And in fact, Joanna will be in conversation with you, introducing you at your book launch at Powell's on June 7th. Can you talk about how Pinewood and the writing group helped with the new book?
Yeah, well, actually, I'm no longer at the Pinewood Table, even though that's where I started working with the Portland writer community. So I'm not there at the moment. But that was the beginning of me learning how to really tell a story that combined humor and the emotional depth that I was reaching for. Stephen Allred and Joanna Rose were huge in helping me see how to talk about like shame and the emotional struggles that I was really feeling.
But you wrote most of the book, or maybe all of it, while you were a member of the writing group?
Not this novel. My first novel I wrote while I was at the Pinewood Table. I Only Cry with Emoticons. I'm in a current writing group with the members of the Pinewood Table.
Oh, okay, but not officially the Pinewood Table.
A different table.
A different table. I think that's true with other writers I've talked to who've started, say, in Tom Spanbauer's Dangerous Writers Group and then formed their own writing groups from there.
Yeah.
They make relationships with the other writers and find an affinity and then go from there.
Yeah. So many of my connections are through that family of writers.
You know, speaking of which, we mentioned communicating to others in real life rather than online and connecting with other people, family, friends, coworkers, other writers, both online and in person. In the book, the narrator, Saul, works at a company called Collaboration Hub, which I imagine was based somewhat on your experience at your collaboration software company. I've worked at several, not collaboration software, but software companies myself. And it doesn't seem like you exaggerated this part of the book all that much.
Yeah, it's funny. One of my dear friends texted me one. They were reading the book last month and said something along the lines of, did this stuff really happen? And I was like, yeah, I mean, it's barely an exaggeration. You know, it's maybe just combining the absurdities from a few startup companies into one story, but I really wasn't doing much exaggerating.
It plays an important part of the book. There's kind of a mysterious voice in the book or message from some kind of gamification plugin that Saul gets off GitHub because he's in a hurry. That's a site where you can just grab some code, which you're not supposed to do if you're using that in a commercial product. Correct. And it gets back at him. So they weren't doing that at your company, were they, Yuvi, the gamification?
Yeah, that ethically questionable behavior, I did fictionalize. I didn't see that in action, even though I heard many stories of how people, you know, with open source software, you're supposed to credit it as appropriate in your own software. And so there's a lot of rules around how you do that. And this character does some ethically questionable stuff. So that wasn't something I saw firsthand. I just heard a lot of stories about that behavior. And then I just had the system sends him messages, and that was fun, just to make up the absurd messages that he was getting.
Oh, I love those parts of the book. And again, very funny, and commenting kind of in an eerie way on what Saul's going through at that particular moment. But the plugin knows a little too much about him.
Yeah. Yeah, that was fun to do. To imagine that, you know, so it's just eerie, so it could still be funny without being too uncomfortable to read.
Now, besides communication and connection, both online and in real life, in person, I'd like to talk about another major theme in the book because it hits close to home for me, and that's the relationship between fathers and sons. Now, in the book, our narrator, Saul, is writing that novel we talked about his grandfather, who had a difficult and complex relationship with his son. In the book, that's Saul's father. And that's also true as well of Saul and his father, a difficult and complex relationship, and Saul and his own 7-year-old son in the book. It's a theme you explore also in your first novel. I thought with Father's Day just around the corner, it's a timely theme to talk about. Saul's grandfather and father are based on your own and your roots in Atlanta. I think you mentioned that in terms of the historical novel you're writing.
Yeah,
and that novel, Saul calls his grandfather Papa. He owns that small store in Georgia, and he's Jewish there, which we mentioned. And as I said, the Ku Klux Klan there is coming to burn the store down. I was going to ask if that's part of your family history, but it seems like that. Did that actually happen?
This is where I definitely fictionalized. All I know through my family stories is my grandfather did own a dry goods store that did not do so well, but you know, he was really close with a lot of people in the town, and there was a threat. Someone threatened that the Klan did not like Jew stores, but the way I've amped it up in my fictionalized stories did not truly happen. It was more just the fear of these things happening. And I read up on some historical events that were appropriate for that time and place as I'm working on my current novel in that realm.
Now, Saul has a 7-year-old son in the book who, despite his age, communicates a lot more easily with the adults in his life than Saul seems to. You have a 12-year-old, Yuvi. Did that relationship influence Saul's relationship with his son? Is that something you were kind of working things out?
Yeah, definitely with my kid, you know, just trying to figure out how to be to them, like how to be a decent parent. And, you know, one thing on my mind a lot, both in the story and in real life, is like, I don't feel like such a, like within this era where we're familiar with toxic masculinity, you know, I never connected with that kind of masculinity. I never had that element in me. I always felt like that was very foreign, that kind of behavior to how I perceive the world. And my kid also is exploring gender and all that. And so alongside like how to be a decent parent is like, you know, what does a dad look like? Like what is a good parent figure and what is a good father figure? And so I started thinking about like, what was my grandfather like to my father? And what was my father like to me? And how every generation, there's like a shift or a change. And sometimes, you know, when you're rebelling against your father, you end up acting more like your grandfather, or, you know, like there's all these echoes of different generations. And I kind of wanted to play with that in the book. Like
that,
both.
That's true in my own life and my father's really? Life. Yeah. I found it very moving and also very relevant.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, as we're rebelling, we're like, I feel like sometimes while we're rebelling, we're also aligning with another generation. And so in the book, I just really wanted to explore that. Like, how do these fathers and children behave with each other?
Yeah. In fact, there's a chapter in the book called Fathers. And there, Saul and his son visit Saul's father in a hospital in Atlanta. Saul's father is there for a possible blood clot. The doctors don't really know, but it could be very serious. It could be a matter of life or death. They don't know yet. The initial visit doesn't go very well, with Saul complaining, quote, "You were gone most of my childhood." And then immediately feeling bad about it. And Saul's father replies, "I tried to be the father. Mine never was for me." And that's exactly, in the book, what Saul's trying to do for his son, maybe what you're trying to do for your child, what I tried to do for mine. And of course, his relationship with his dad. That's something that seems so, it just hit so close to home. It seemed that it was coming from a real life experience on your part, maybe with the relationships between your grandfather, your father, you, and your kid.
Yeah. You know, I fictionalized some elements, like my father wasn't a workaholic the way this father was, but it was definitely this idea that, you know, my younger self, like when I was in my 20s, I was very angry at my father for not being the father I wanted him to be. And then I realized like, oh, he was trying to fix the things that didn't quite work great from his father. And that, you know, then I grew much closer to my father, realizing, you know, he gave me a comfortable life. He helped me become an adult-ish person. And so, you know, so then I grew a lot closer. And, you know, but it's interesting, I do this with Saul in the book, where he gets upset, but then he feels all this affection and love for his father, but then he remembers another feeling, and he just kind of walking this line as he's working it out to himself. And that was really something true to me. And my grandfather was, I was very young when he died. I was maybe 12 or 13, but he was just such a goofball. And I remember how frustrated my grandmother and sometimes my father, they were with him, because he was just kind of an irresponsible goofball, but he was such a delight, if, you know, from the right way of looking at it. So I don't know if that's too circuitous of an answer.
Oh, not at all. I think it's just a very complex relationship. There's the good that you see, and then there's the bad, and then there might be old hurts that never go away. And maybe you reach an understanding, as I think Saul does in the book with his mother. He had a difficult childhood with her, and then he finds, I won't tell, I give that away, but he finds out why. And that gives him a degree of understanding where he can come to terms. We mentioned Liz Scott and her memoir, which was This Never Happened. She writes about her relationships in the book with her parents, with a focus in her book on the mother. So mothers and daughters rather than fathers and sons. but she included this epigraph, which is attributed to Anonymous. So I don't know if she got it from Anonymous or if she made it up, but it's so beautiful. Our parents are the ones who both wound us and administer our bandages. And that seems like it applies not only to Saul in the book, but to you and me, maybe.
Oh, that's wonderful. You can remove this part, but I can't help but think, just to bring this too lowbrow, to Homer Simpson, where he talks about alcohol as the cause of and the solution to all of life's problems.
Yes, there's good and bad about everything, I guess, huh? Parents and alcohol.
But yeah, I mean, I love that. That's wonderful, that from Liz Scott's book. And I did think about that a lot. And, you know, even though the mother is, in a way, she's never on screen in my book because she's dead she's dead before the book start. I really also wanted to explore his relationship to his mother, who once again, you know, he maybe felt like he lost something. I mean, he didn't have something he wanted from his mother during the time he had with her. But in the end, he understood a lot more about how she loved him and how incredible a person she was. And so I really wanted to explore that too, his how we make amends even when the person isn't there. Right now, my mother is alive and did not have the alcoholism that is in this book, but still those elements are something that I felt close to talk about.
I want to mention, too, a few pages after that hospital room scene with Saul, his son, and his father, who's in the hospital bed, Saul reflects on that moment and says, I wanted my dad to be more involved in my world when I was a kid, but maybe I'm getting too involved trying to protect my boy's world. I'm doing the same thing by doing the opposite thing. And at that point, UV, I was thinking, as fathers, will we ever get it right?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, the thing that I had to come to terms with is there is no perfectly right, because I, you know, I can see I'm doing that with my kid all the time, where I'm like trying to be like so sensitive and not get upset in the way I might have. I remember my father would get upset, and I'm going too far in the other direction. And then I'm like, wait, but I'm being too sensitive about everything, and this isn't great either.
Yeah, and a lot of it is the time when the father is raising the child. I don't remember my father ever hitting me, but very often, if my sister and I did something, he would say, I'm going to get the belt. So I don't know if we took him seriously past a certain point, but there was always that threat there. And it was a very common thing to physically discipline children, to hit them. Even in schools, I was in schools in New York and Los Angeles, high school in Los Angeles, the vice principal had a paddle. Wow. Can you imagine that, bringing these 16, 17-year-old kids, big kids, into his office, telling them to lean over and paddling them? He got away with it then. They got away with it then. You couldn't do that now. Well, maybe in certain states.
Each state might be a little different.
Right. We'll have to have the Supreme Court weigh in on that. Huh? Now, throughout most of the book, Saul's son is referred to as the boy, very generically. We don't learn his actual name. I hope I'm not giving too much away. It's August, or Augie for short, until about 3/4 through the novel. I was trying to figure out the reason for that. I thought maybe it made the relationship more universal, for me at least, and maybe for Saul himself, making it easier for him to see himself in his son and Saul's relationship to the boy in terms of Saul's relationship to his own father. Was there an intent there, something like that?
Yeah, you know, that was interesting. And I kind of went around a few times with how to handle that. Like there are a few references where someone's like, why don't you use their name? You know, both, why I say they, because the son isn't named and the ex-wife isn't named. They're just like the boy and the ex.
Yes, I picked up right away on Augie. Again, it comes about 3/4 through the book. But while I was preparing for the interview, I write down the characters and I'm going, okay, the ex-wife, did I miss something? And I have the print version, so I couldn't do a search for ex-wife name or something, but she's never named in the book.
There's one quick reference. His friend Anne references it towards the beginning, and then her name comes back a little more towards the end. And I think in the end, the reason why I kept it was simply because it was almost like he had too much trouble like they weren't almost their own people separate from him, you know, so they were just all these people in relation to him. It's like my boy or the boy and my ex. And it wasn't until later on where he can kind of give them their own identity a little bit more, where he learns at least just that they have their own names and their own lives and they're not completely intertwined with him all the time.
Which shows some of the depersonalization of online collaboration and communication. Yeah. It's not the same as in person, where you tend to see the person more as a human rather than just text.
Yeah, and since it was such a book about connection and disconnection, online, offline, I also kind of messed with the way that this character didn't know how to distinguish these people from himself at first.
Now, there's a metaphor in the book, well, several, but one I particularly love, Saul's girlfriend, who's named Kitty. She's mentioned several times. She's even fictionalized in Saul's novel as Catty. her job in real life is selling piggy banks, antique piggy banks, novelty piggy banks. And she gives a few to Saul's son as a gift. Saul takes a look at them, sees that they have a slot to put the money in, but he doesn't see any way to open it up and take the money out. The boy tells him, well, of course you break the thing, duh. Saul says, that's so sad. But Kitty replies, it's beautiful. And it is. And it's saying something about, I guess, how we come to realizations, to understandings. Maybe there's something that needs to break before we gain any wisdom.
Yeah, this one thing I like about writing is... my favorite thing are the metaphors that I don't realize I've made until I'm working them through. So like it wasn't until I was it was later than the first draft and Kitty was, selling piggy banks on eBay and Etsy and all this stuff. And then it just hit me while I was writing the book, like, wait, how do you get the money out? And then, I was like, duh, I remember. But then it was such a delight to be like, oh, that metaphor will really be wonderful in a few ways to interpret it. One other element is, the idea of breaking things and the ending of life and the ending of relationships and also the nostalgia for things, where he can't let go of things in the past and move on. And so he wants to cling to his old marriage that has kind of fallen apart, or he wants to cling to old technology, even like the title of the book, I Only Cry with Emoticons, this is a little too nerdy for a lot of audience member or readers, but emoticon is sort of like the old school emoji. Like emoticons are, like text characters of the smiley face is a colon and a parenthesis.
Right. Now it's an actual picture.
Yeah. And, but this character Saul is sort of nostalgic for slightly older tech than the tech that is at the moment. And so he's a little stuck in the past in various ways. And anyway, so all that to say that I love the few ways that this piggy bank metaphor could work for the themes in the story.
It reminds me of a quote I somehow associated with Leonard Cohen, but I don't know if that's, it's we break and we get wounded and that's because it lets the light in. It's the only way to let the light in. Was just a beautiful way of looking at living. We get hurt, there's wounds, there's scars, but that lets the light come in. And of course, that's a very Buddhist principle too. I think the first noble truth is that life is suffering. And the other two, three, and four noble truths are it's necessary for us to be compassionate and come to understanding for all living beings, for all sentient beings.
Nice.
Well, I mean, it's your metaphor. Yeah. The piggy bank. I think you were saying something in a very creative and different way there.
Yeah, but it really is. It was interesting just to think that through. But the struggle and the pain was really interesting to work through in this book in silly and metaphoric ways.
Now, Kitty, of course, with that "it's beautiful" has a lot of wisdom. So does Augie, Saul's son. At one point, well, throughout most of the book, Saul's having trouble writing his novel. But at one point, he gives a copy of the manuscript to Kitty. She gives it back to him with comments, but also quite a few illustrations. And in a passage in the book, Saul's browsing Powell's, and he goes to the graphic novel section. And he says, "What amazes me is how few words it requires for them to convey something powerful. The pictures are not necessarily so complex either, but together the pictures and words can do amazing things." And you do this, Yuvi, in your blog posts and in your YouTube videos. I was wondering, well, you're working on this historical novel now. Is there a graphic novel in the future? Is that something you're considering with you doing the illustrations?
Oh, that's so interesting. I do like this. In YouTube, I love to do these stick figure animations as I'm working through, whether it's talking about the creative process or my chronic migraines or anything. I love to do it through these crude stick figures. I hadn't ever thought about, I mean, it seems obvious now that you mention it, but you know, the idea of doing a graphic novel in that sense, because I still don't think of myself as able to draw properly.
I think you draw very effectively, and people can just look at your YouTube channel, and I think that will confirm my opinion. You don't have to be a great draftsman or Salvador Dali or something like that, but Norman Rockwell, you know, the realistic thing. But I think you get the point across with your drawings.
Yeah, well, I really it was an interesting racket how the YouTube all started, was because I wanted to explain stuff and I didn't want to have my face on the screen the whole time. And so I was like, what is the minimum that I can do visually to help tell this story I want to tell? So I was like, well, put the stick figure, have him carrying a bag of manure, and that'll convey the burden of chronic headaches or whatever, whatever I want it. So
the power of pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. Just the simplest possible visuals. But I did, while writing this book, appreciate the beauty of graphic novels. Not that I don't know much about that world, so I can't speak much to it. I just started to realize what you can do in that form.
I have to say, I'm with Saul. That's also my favorite section of Powell's. It's not just comic books anymore. There's a whole lot of amazing stuff in there. Yuvi, one last question. Near the end of the book, Saul's talking about his mother, and he says, "In those last years, my mom would ask me about my writing, but it didn't give me a terrible feeling like when others asked. She didn't care about publications or publishers. She didn't care if the book was a critical success. She asked about how it all felt, or she asked what I had discovered. The last time I remember her asking me anything, we were on the phone and she was drunk, and I was just so frustrated by the drinking that I failed to appreciate her question. Have you learned anything new and icky about yourself?" And that's my last question for you. In writing the book and looking at it as a voyage of discovery, have you learned anything new and icky about yourself?
that's a great question. I would think that I should be more ready for it. But, you know, I think that's my whole writing, my whole creative process, especially in the most recent 20 years of my life. Everything I'm doing creatively is to kind of uncover something new and icky about myself and work through that stuff. And, you know, I think with this book, what I was trying to process the most, even though this can sound cliche, actually it is cliche because it's a cliche in the book. The slogan for the fictional company, Collaboration Hub, is, "We take collaboration to the next level," trademark. All right. You know, I repeatedly say that. But I think the icky thing that I had to learn while writing this book was how to really be honest and deep with the people around me, like not to be fake in these areas that I was being fake. So, you know, sometimes like maybe my wife would know the real me, but I wouldn't be as honest with coworkers or friends. And, you know, it's not like I want to spill my guts to the cashier when I'm trying to pay for my groceries or anything, but I still just trying to be more sincere and connected with people. And I guess I thought for some reason, my job was done and I had done all the work I needed to do. And as I was working through this book, I really was thinking about like, oh, I'm insincere in more places than I realized. And I can step it up a little. And even if I don't, you know, spill my guts beyond the boundaries of whatever interaction I'm having, I can at least make that 30-second interaction honest. And if I'm not having an awesome day, I don't have to say I'm doing awesome.
And you could see a lot of that honesty and bravery, I think, in your podcasts and your YouTube videos and your blog posts. Even in light of what you said about fictionalizing, helping you say things without getting too personal.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much. And I mean, I feel like your ability, I've always seen in your conversations with people is, you know, getting to the real essence of what people are dealing with. So.
Well, Yuvi, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I know we focused on the more serious aspects of I Only Cry With Emoticons, the communication theme, the fathers and sons, but I should tell listeners, it's really a comic novel at heart, both very funny. And very moving. Mazel tov on the new book.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. It was great to be here.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it, if we had a director, you could listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Yuvi Zalko, author of the new novel, I Only Cry With Emoticons, from Red Hand Press. Yuvi will be launching the new book in conversation with Joanna Rose at Powell's City of Books on Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. He'll also be reading at Annie Bloom's Books on Tuesday, August 16th, and Broadway Books on Wednesday, September 14th. You can learn about all of Yuvi's events and his work online at yuvizalko.com. Just a reminder that KBOO is in the final stretch of our spring drive. We're trying to raise $56,000 by May 28th, which is just 2 days away, and we could use your help. KBOO is true listener-sponsored community radio. We get 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today. It's as simple as going to the KBOO website, kboo.org, and clicking on the big donate button, or you can text KBOO to 44321. And if you donate now, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $7,000, thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Together, we can keep KBOO and community radio going strong. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, June 9th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
you know, this thing goes a lot better when it's animated.